Very good.
Nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, welcome to hour two of our little show here. We had a great conversation with Matthew Arrett. Boy, he was fun, wasn't he? And somebody else coming up here that I think you're going to find quite interesting. I saw a couple of the two or three of the videos that David Martin put together, and I go, well, man, I want to talk to this fellow. He's a business fellow, a professor, author, storyteller, inventor, oracle, father, friend, and creator of the MCAM CNBC IQ 100 Index. I have no idea what that is. He specializes in putting humanity back into humans and business. And he's been talking about some of the legalities and constitutionality of COVID. And Mr. Martin, David Martin, first of all, welcome. That might be a good place to start, do you think?
Patrick, it's a delight to be with you. Thank you for having me. Oh, and yeah, the list of what I do is simplified in that I like to live every day to its fullest.
Wow, good for you. And you're able to make a living doing that. I mean, that's the Buddhists call that right livelihood, you know.
Well, you know, it's actually funny that you say that. I often comment on the fact that people talk about making a living, and I think the majority of people forget that the living part comes first and the making it is second. So I subscribe to the notion that if you're doing the right things and you are treating others in a right and respectable way, that the provisioning for your life flows as a result of it, not the other way around. So just my way of looking at the world.
Oh, I like it. I like it. So looking at the world from a real critical thinker, as you've been for a long time, give us big picture of what you feel is going on here, maybe spiritually, philosophically, with this whole corona thing.
Well, I think we need to put it in the context of a much bigger lens. If we look over the last certainly 20 years, and I would draw the line back to probably the last 50 years, there has been a progressive sense in America and around the world that the citizens of this country and the citizens of the world cannot manage their own best interest and must have some sort of kind of anonymous paternalistic impulse managing things for them. And what that did after the Second World War, after, you know, the experience with President Kennedy and Dr. King and others, what happened was we built a culture where there was a request by a government to trust them against the backdrop of a series of activities and behaviors which were untrustworthy. And I think what we're having play out in nearly comic extreme right now is that we are being asked to put our faith and confidence in people who have not only done nothing to earn it, but have actually tested the limits of credulity on whether or not you can even pass a simple laugh test to how impossible and preposterous the propositions are. The notion, for example, that it is in our best interest to isolate from each other at a time of potential crisis, and we'll get into the whole issue of even if there is a crisis, but the fact of the matter is, we are being given the mandates, which by their very definition show us that they have no basis in reality and fact, right? When people are told you cannot be present for the passing of an ill and aged person and they must die alone, when you're told that you cannot grieve the loss and honor the life of someone who has passed, when you're told that you can't worship and assemble and connect, those strike at the core of what living is. And so this illusion that's being manufactured that somehow or another it is in our interest to survive a virus, which as I've said many times, the number of viruses that we encounter throughout every day of our life is innumerable. And the fact that we happen to now name one against the backdrop of the millions that we encounter is on its face, both scientifically and energetically, a self-evident falsehood. The fact of the matter is coronavirus, you know, is part of the giant universe of viruses. That's true. That some people who are exposed to it also die is probably true. But the notion that somehow or another we can let still to this day, I mean, if we just look at the facts alone still show us that pneumonia is killing more people than coronavirus-associated disorders. But we don't care about the people who are dying with the unbranded disease. We only care about the ones that we've decided to brand. Those fundamental human attributes, which say that if human life is precious and if human life matters, then the notion that we create an illusion around a brand of illness and a brand of death and let the rest of the world go unconsidered is anathema to everything that is human. And when those kinds of things happen, it is self-evident that there is another agenda or a set of agendas playing out. And in this particular situation, the most evident, and by the way, the most empirically shown, is that against the backdrop of this particular pandemic scare, what's happening in the financial world is without precedent in terms of the scale of economic redistribution of assets and resources. And it's happening at a time when the economic and political system is rearranging. And I feel like I'm in the middle of that wonderful movie where you're being yelled at and they say, you can't handle the truth.
Right. Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, we can handle the truth. The problem is those individuals who are trying to do things that ultimately will harm the masses and benefit the few do not want the truth to be spoken about. So they come up with this elaborate cover story. They have us constantly glued to our smartphones and our TVs and our computers because that's the only thing we can do in isolation. And then they pump information into our brains and we're supposed to ignore the fact that we're being robbed.
David Martin is with us, Patrick Timpone. Wow, that's quite an opening. So there could be so many motives to this whole thing, Mr. Martin, of behavior modification, whatever, getting rid of President Trump by destroying the economy. Lots of, you know, in detective stories, they always say who benefits, right? There's lots of benefit, a lot of benefactors with this, isn't there?
Yeah, so let's look at the big picture here. There is without question that President Trump, let's remove the question of the individual for a moment.
Yeah.
And let's look at the time in the administration. The administration that was going to preside over the period between 2016 and 2020 was going to face what I referred to in 2011 as a President Hoover-like event. Now, the reason I said that is because for the last 25 years, there has been a consistent abuse of pensions, of entitlement programs, and of unchecked debt structures, which in their maturity were going to come due during this administration. By the way, it has nothing to do with whether Trump won or Hillary won or anybody else won. At the end of the day, whoever was in the White House during this period was going to have a cumulative effect of 25 plus years of fiscal mismanagement come due. And that's not me forecasting anything. That was something that if you look back in the early 2000s, you'll see that every Congressional Budget Office assessment, every Inspector General review, everybody said that things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national debt, and pensions were going to be underfunded and the due date was going to be coming due during this period. Now, there is no question, and I'm not saying that this is the sole cause of what's going on, but there's no question that we are being forced into a psychological operation to imprint the year 2020 in the public consciousness as the excuse for a financial mismanagement that is decades old. So when you go to claim your pension, when you go to wonder why your 401k is empty, when you go to see that the life insurance annuity that you thought you were paying for, you don't actually get the full benefit of, you are going to be told, and by the way, you can play this tape 10 years from now, and I can guarantee you, people will be saying, well, yeah, but you remember 2020. This is a psychological imprint of a trauma, which is going to be used to justify a series of malevolent actions and irresponsible fiduciary failings on the part of pension managers, private equity firms, and entitlement program managers. And we're being given the opportunity for our mind control moment to be, remember the Alamo, remember 9/11, remember 2020. And the problem with that thing is that we won't be remembering the right thing, right? We don't remember what those things actually meant. We just remember that they were imprinted in our brains. And when they're imprinted in our brains, they serve as a justification for the unaccountable, unasked question, which is, yes, but is that what really happened?
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's why I said, you know, as much as there are opportunists, right? So there's no question that Democratic governors want to push an economic recovery as far out as they can
of course.
They think it's the economy stupid is an electoral mandate that says that if they can keep the economy suppressed, that they can dislocate President Trump. There's no question that you can't look at the evidence without seeing that the whole idea of crushing small business, making restaurants and gyms and theaters impossible to reopen, which, by the way, this is where people go to have conversations about politics. This is where they go to have informed discussions with their friends and their colleagues and their opponents, right? That erasure of the public venue does nothing but help play into, in isolation, there is no question that the Democratic governor's calculus is keep things unstable, and at the last moment swoop in with the electoral promises that say, if you elect us, we'll reopen safely. And they think they're going to dislodge President Trump. The problem is their self-evident, self-serving lies, where they're trying to prop up the justification for these things, gets more and more and more flimsy every day. Because the fact of the matter is, people aren't getting sick and dying of coronavirus. In fact, most people who are exposed to coronavirus are perfectly healthy and don't have a problem. And over a period of time, the self-evident nature of the lie is going to start looking like a manipulation. And as a result, it's probably going to backfire. You probably could do nothing. If you're a Democratic governor right now, you can do nothing to help Trump more than to dig your heels in and keep the economy closed.
That's interesting. It's interesting you mentioned the idea of 2020 being, you know, the boogaboo for the problem like 9/11. And wasn't it true about 10 years ago or 12 years ago where they called it the subprime crisis, right? Subprime crisis. And they blamed it on all these ninja loans. And we were doing money shows back then, Mr. Martin, with the very smart people. And you could have made all of these subprime loans go away if you wanted to, I think, for $150 billion. And the whole thing would have been done if that was the problem.
Yeah.
Which it wasn't.
Well, but if you go back and look at, you know, what was called the global financial crisis.
Right.
Once again, a beautiful brand of what wasn't the case.
Beautiful brand.
What was the case was the fact that credit default swaps, which most people don't understand, most people don't spend any time understanding. But credit default swaps, at the end of the day, if you put it very simply, are a bet against humanity, right? It's a bet that you're not going to fulfill your obligation. That's what a credit default swap is. Now, if you make a bet against humanity and humanity doesn't deliver on your disappointment, you have a problem. And the funny thing is, what happened was, and this goes back to what, you know, President Bush did right after 9/11. You know, he liberalized not only the way in which financial assets could be leveraged, but what happened was, when we turned our houses, which are 30-year mortgages, into consumer credit ATMs, you know, take a second mortgage to pay off your credit card. Well, what that message was, and unfortunately the public didn't catch on to it, but what that message was change the duration of the maturity of your underlying assets. And when you change the duration of a 30-year asset like a mortgage and you turn it into consumer credit, what you do is you create not a bet against humanity. It was actually a manipulation of a mismatch of the asset classes. And so the credit default swap failure, which ultimately led to over $40 trillion of financial appropriation from public taxable sources into a few banks and a few financial institutions, that was a $40 trillion asset transfer, but we call it the global financial crisis.
Let's unpack that a little bit, because I've never heard it really explained like that, which is, to me, is fascinating, loving to study these things. So let's take Patrick, who has a 30-year mortgage in 2008, and walk us through of what I maybe did to be part of this little scheme.
Yeah, so when you are told, so let's go back to 1913, when the Federal Reserve set up this very mysterious 30-year duration, which people don't really ever ask, where did 30 years come from? The answer, if you go back to 1910, which is where the notes on this are actually recorded, the rationale for the 30-year mortgage was that the productive life expectancy of the blue-collar worker at the turn of the last century. So when we went from the 18s to the 19s, the average productive life expectancy of the blue-collar worker was 30 years. Now, the reason why 30 years becomes important is because when you create an asset class that's 30 years long, you're doing it not for banks, but you're doing it for life insurers. Life insurers have to have long-dated assets. That's how life insurance works. They have to get a little bit of money today for a payout 30 years from now. Now, the problem is you have to manufacture an asset that has the same match duration. And so the 30-year mortgage was born not of banking mandates, but of life insurance mandates.
Life insurance mandates. So life insurers needed some collateral.
Right. Life insurers needed to have something, because remember what happens. What's the devil's bargain in life insurance? You in your life consume a little bit more than you probably can pay for. You have a house that's a little more expensive than you probably should have. But the life insurance sales proposition since after the end of the Civil War was you don't want to leave your family in debt. But the presumption was you were going to spend beyond your means. And so this very interesting addiction is formed, which is I can go ahead and spend beyond my means because I have a life insurance policy, but the life insurance policy benefits whom? And this is what people don't understand. People don't understand that the life insurance policy beneficiary in most instances is you paying off the debt of the people who just died. It's not a lottery win, right? We're not betting on the luxurious life we're going to have after somebody dies. We're betting on the fact that we can cover the expenses that they racked up that they didn't pay for. And so by linking the mortgage of a house and the duration of life insurance to each other, which is what the Federal Reserve did in 1913, and the reason why, by the way, in 1911, the Peugeot Committee and others were very angry about what they called the interlocking directorates, the fact that life insurances and bank companies had these interlocking relationships. The problem with that was we created this mismatch. And the whole economic system of the last century was built on the 30-year duration asset, which is your house was 30 years, your life insurance, in most instances, you covered for 30 years, your employment to pension receipts was 30 years. We built this whole illusion around 30 years. And then in 2001, after the events of September 2001, what happened was we changed a couple very simple things. If you recall, President Bush changed the amount of FDIC insured deposits. We went from $100,000, which you and I remember every time we walked into a bank, mm-hmm. the little plastic sticker on the door said, your deposits are insured up to $100,000. Well, overnight, President Bush changed that to $250,000.
I remember, yes.
But to do that, to actually deal with that, he didn't change the insurance that was being paid to the FDIC. And this is a little fact that nobody ever looked at. The FDIC didn't get more money. So essentially what we did was we guaranteed a thing that we weren't actually guaranteeing. We created the illusion of a guarantee, but it actually wasn't guaranteed. And so what happened was, at the exact same time that banks were getting record amounts of cash, which was this increased deposit, they also had a need to generate assets. So what they did was they took the 30-year mortgage and said, well, we need to refinance that, but we need to bring consumer credit into the picture, because the only way to manufacture debt is to consolidate debt. So you now take houses and you mash them up with credit cards. And the effect of that is that you now take the 30-year duration of a mortgage and you shrink the credit asset value of that by however much consumer credit you blended into the real estate credit. So housing values didn't go up. You know, the real estate value didn't go up. What did go up was a higher debt to consumer, each debt to consumer ratio. That went up. And that's the reason why the credit default swap market went through the roof. And the problem then is when you have alleged mortgages, remember all these mortgage consolidation companies in the mid-2000s.
Right.
Oh, consolidate your mortgage, consolidate your mortgage. Those consolidators effectively were buying mortgages as though they were 30-year secured assets, when in fact what they were buying was essentially consumer credit. And so what blew up in 2008 and then what blew up again in 2011 was the fact that the structural mismatch, and by the way, listen to what I just said, 2008, 2011, what were those? Those were the 7-year and 10-year maturity duration defaults. So the reason why I could talk about this, and I did, I wrote about it in 2006, I wrote the order of bank failures that were going to happen in 2008. How did I do it? I just looked at the credit default swaps and knew when the maturities were going to hit and who was holding the bag when the music stopped. And so the reason I was so allegedly prescient was not because I'm smart. I just happened to read ISDA contracts that nobody else was reading. And it turns out that they have maturity dates in them. And when they have maturity dates, you go, oh, that's a date on a calendar. And it turns out that 2008 was not a surprise and 2011 isn't a surprise. And tragically, 2020 is also not a surprise. So okay. So that's why I'm saying this had to happen. The fact that we manufactured this illusion with respect to, let's blame a virus for it, is basically a convenience. But the public is being had, because the truth is that once again, and you see this, by the way, in Congress, right now, trillions of dollars are being pumped into banks. And as much as I hear people talk about it, I still shudder with the ignorance that says that when you're told that you're going to get a payroll protection loan, you're going to get a small business loan, you're going to get all these things and they're going to be government guaranteed, people are not realizing that what we're doing is creating assets for banks. We're not helping people. We're creating assets for banks. And when those assets become either devalued or when people can't repay their loans, the banks win by foreclosing. So Congress hasn't helped the American small business. Congress has not passed a single act that helped small business. What Congress did was put money in the form of credit assets into banks. And once again, we're being robbed in plain sight, and no one is calling it out.
So, in other words, similar to what the IMF does to countries in trouble, you create money and give it
to
them.
That's exactly right.
Similar. So what about, say, the 1,200 promised dollars? They just get borrowed from the Fed with treasury bonds, right, and give it to the people. What's that about? I mean, what does that do to the whole picture?
Yeah, but see, $1,200. First of all, I have yet to meet anybody in any part of the country for whom $1,200 was enough to cover their month's expenses when we shut the country down.
Of course, yeah.
$1,200 was buying votes. It was not helping the economy, because you've got rent payments, you've got utility bills, you've got insurance bills, you've got all sorts of things. And if you actually read the language of the authorization, and I ask people to read the language of the authorization of not only the stimulus packages, but the small business packages. And do you realize that in the first four lines, before you ever get to payroll, before you get to any consumer benefit, the specific authorization in the law that was passed by Congress was so that you can keep paying your life insurance premiums?
Is that right? Really?
I'm dead serious.
Interesting.
Before the human being, before the laborer, before the individual was even mentioned, Congress wanted to make sure that employers could keep paying their life insurance premiums.
And is that part of the deal, Mr. Martin, where if they do that, then maybe they'll forgive the loan?
That's correct.
Oh, whoa. David Martin is with it. Boy, you're a real financial geek, man. I love talking to you. This is great. Man, I tell you what. Stay right there. I got to do a couple commercials, okay?
Not a problem.
David Martin is here, and we're going to get into do some of these people who are mandating that you stay 6 feet away from your dog, and that, do they have any authority? Also, more about this idea of they needed this corona thing, kind of like I guess they did with the Great Depression. So we have lots to talk about. Stay right there if you care to join us. Patrick at OneRadioNetwork.com. We're live here May 20. Previously with cardiologist Dr. Joel Kahn, 35 years experience in cardiology.
On your commercial break, you hit a hot button because I'm a giant fan of infrared sauna and the cardiac benefits.
Tell us about why you like these saunas for the heart. What does it do?
In Japan, it's a traditional therapy of heart disease to even sick heart patients to sit for 15 or 20 minutes in an infrared sauna, then lie down and rest and hydrate for about half an hour. They call it Waon, W-A-O-N. It means soothing heat. And they've done research studies, like 30 of them, in humans. Anti-ages your arteries and improves the strength of your heart, and it may actually prolong survival in sick heart patients. Anybody can just, again, go to the internet, read about infrared sauna heart disease, or put my name there because I've written many articles about it. Now there's data coming out of Sweden and Finland because they've published some amazing data. The number of times a week you're in a sauna, number of minutes each time, you can just track out how long you're going to live. So very powerful therapy by being in, my favorite is an infrared sauna.
And think about, so this is just like the heart. Think about the detoxification effects with, we know that some of these loose particles running around in the air and the water and the food and that get stuck in the fat cells, and they come out when you do the sweating. And it's a wonderful thing. It will help your parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest system, get more in line. So if you have trouble sleeping, it's a great thing to do right before you go to sleep, and you'll go 90 blinkers and have a really good time. We have a special price that is only available if you email me. We're not allowed to put it in print. They want to keep the retail price kind of happy on Mr. Google. Is email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and ours is 1,150 Federal Reserve notes, such as they are, will trade you 1,150 Federal Reserve notes for one of these saunas delivered in the lower 48, and we ship them all over the world. We've shipped them to, Canada, Alaska, not Alaska. We've never gone up to Alaska, but Japan, everywhere. South Korea, the only place where we can't ship them is Germany, and there's some probably political thing there. I don't know why that is, but they'll come with the proper plug. Just email me, patrick@oneradionetwork.com. So much is talked about with 5G and EMFs, and we've done so many shows over the years. This is a technology out of Australia that we think is very valuable. Listen. Previously, we talked with Brandon Amalani about his Blue Shield product to protect against EMFs in your home.
The more connected we are, the more electromagnetic radiation we're going to have. So years ago, I'd play with Q-Links and just anything I can get my hands on that, whether I felt it working or not, I just wanted some kind of leverage against electromagnetic radiation and those frequencies and how they affect the cellular biology. But then when I met Mark and started really getting deep to his technology and really looking at the microprocessing technology, I've never found any EMF company that would not only to test on not only human blood and urine analysis, but also on animals, which totally weeds out the idea of placebo effect. I mean, the fact that you can plug these devices into a chicken farm, a factory farm, for about 15,000 laying hens, and all of a sudden the mortality rate, which is averages from 60 to 150 deaths per month, goes down to zero. I mean, it's pretty profound that a little device, a little energy device, could actually like create such a harmony and balance within the environment to where claustrophobic chickens that are crammed in together actually get along better and actually feel better. The biological markers are improved over that 1 year study.
There's quite a bit of science with this Blue Shield product. You can see the ad on the front page. Promo code One Radio will get you a 10% discount. This works on the cells in the body. Very cool technology. Front page, Blue Shield, OneRadioNetwork.com.
To talk to Patrick, call 888-663-6386 or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Know the source. One Radio Network.
Hope you're enjoying the show. I am David Martin is with us. He is founder and chairman of MCAM. It's an international leader in innovative finance. Pretty innovative stuff. It sounds like what he's talking about. Trade intangible asset finance. He's a developer of the first innovation-based quantitative index of public equities and is a managing partner of Purple Ridge Funds. Purple Ridge Funds. So so you're saying, David Martin, that you were able to see a few years ago that something was going to happen in 2020 similar to what happened in 2008 just by looking at the numbers, correct? You could see it.
That is correct.
You could see it. And was it just the amount of dollar-denominated debt, or I guess there were several factors there?
Yeah, I think the bigger thing, obviously debt is a big problem, but the bigger thing was the fact that you'll recall several years ago that companies started making announcements that they were using debt as a way to both pay dividends as well as buy back shares. That's a problematic thing, because what you're doing when you do that is you're using effectively publicly underwritten assets. Because remember, when the government makes money cheap, making money cheap has to be paid for down the road. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pay for it, you get problems. But what happened was that we had companies like Apple that, you know, keep most of their cash overseas. They were borrowing from United States dollars. They were borrowing at low rates and using those funds to pay dividends. And other companies were doing that. Well, what happens over a period of time is people get this idea that borrowing against assets is a good idea. And before long, you have private equity firms that are borrowing against pensions. You have severe warnings that were coming out of the Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation after some of the famous pension shortfalls that we heard about in the earlier part of the 2010s. You'll recall the Orange County pension default. You'll recall several others that were very headline grabbing when they happened, but people didn't pay attention to the fact that these were individual organizations, financial institutions that were taking public promises about the way money was going to be managed, the fiduciary future of the citizens of the United States. And they were betting against that money using what was effectively gaming the cost of credit. Now, the problem is whenever that happens, and this is not, it's not a mystery. The difference between me and most other people is I just read credit agreements and I read these documents. And if you read them, they all have maturities. And the maturity, the easiest way, by the way, Patrick, if your listeners want to go and look at this, most listeners probably don't even know this organization exists. It's actually nearly as old as the FDIC in terms of its current construction. But there's an organization called the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or PBGC. If you go back and look at PBGC's own writings for the last decade, they have been dire in their warning that there are gross underfunded pensions, there are gross underfunded annuity programs. But worse than that, remember, Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation sounds like an insurance company, doesn't it? The reason why it sounds like an insurance company is because it is. It's the United States government guaranteeing the promises that were being made by corporations and others. Tiny problem, they weren't collecting enough revenue to actually fulfill their own guarantee. So now you have the insurance company who's supposed to insure the fact that pensions work, itself not being able to fulfill its own obligations. That maturity, the certainty that we were going to hit this cliff, was a certainty that was described as early as 2008 in the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation reviews, and not a single public financial network, no major media covered the fact that we were being told there's an iceberg ahead and we've got a drunk captain at the helm. And then we wonder why we hit the iceberg.
Interesting. Wow. So let's go to Corona. And so we have, let's say Dollarink, right? This whoever owns Dollarink, we call them the boys around here, Mr. Martin, the boys. The boys own.
I love talking to somebody who still sounds like they live in Texas.
That's right, the boys. The boys own Dollarink. So they knew this is coming, and so they had to create, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is this accurate? The Dollarink people, the bankers and the big pharma, they had to create something to be the catalyst for 2020. Correct. So they could blame it on it. So,
correct. Because what you don't want to do is you don't want to get caught with your hands in the cookie jar.
Yeah, in the cookie jars. So you're exactly saying that the corona is the boogeyman that they've created. So that would mean that they would be involved with Fauci, WHO, all kinds of people to the media to make this whole thing fly like they've done.
Yeah, but listen, it's not hard. Let's remember something. And by the way, I just vented. I had a little moment with my wife last night where I vented my frustration.
Did you?
At the fact that Andrew Cuomo was reported to have said yesterday that professional sports teams need to play without spectators.
Oh, really?
Now let's just unpack that for a minute. What on earth would make a governor of a state that has some pretty notorious teams, both for good and ill. But what would make a governor say, hey, it's really important that we keep sports playing, just have no spectators, unless you were interested in getting individuals glued to television sets where you can control the advertising dollar? See, nobody's actually unpacking the self-evident layer. Right. The reason why a governor would say play sports, but don't let spectators come in, is because if you want to control the message, what you want is you want people in front of their TV sets, because, and I guarantee you this, what's going to happen is political action committees. And why would New York want this? Well, New York would want it because they want to control the message that you hear. If you hear your buddy talking next to you at the ball game, you're probably not going to be listening to the propaganda that they're shoving down your throat.
Wow.
But if you actually only can observe sports on TV, what is going to happen? You're going to get message control. If you are Bill Gates, is it any surprise that you suddenly find yourself appearing as an expert on major news networks? Of course it's not a surprise. When you pay people for essentially a paid political, or in his case, a propaganda advertisement, guess what you get? You get airtime. And the more we can keep people in front of their electronics, the more we can keep them in front of their TVs, the more we can keep them in front of their smartphones and their laptops, the more we can make sure the message is controlled. And that, you know, if I was wrong, by the way, you wouldn't see the Facebooks and the YouTubes censoring content. They didn't censor content when it was people manipulating elections. In fact, Zuckerberg himself said, oh, that was too complicated to detect. But it isn't too complicated to detect the fact that I can actually post a peer-reviewed National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease study in 2005 that actually its headline was, you know, chloroquine has been effective against SARS. I can't post that today, despite the fact that it came out of Anthony Fauci's own division at National Institutes of Health. I can't post it today because that is detectable. And you sit there and you say, this is all about message control. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't a manipulation, if it wasn't a propaganda campaign, then citizens would be allowed to have divergent opinions. But the fact is that the individual orchestrators of this event, and I've called them co-conspirators because it meets the legal definition in antitrust of a co-conspirator. That's why I call them that. But when you actually look at the fact that you have a set of organizations who, like in 1911, right? And all I'm using is historical precedent. In 1911, the Peugeot Committee got together and said that it is unethical for a single financial interest to control so many different parts of your life. It turns out that if you do the interlocking directorates map today of the coronavirus campaign, not surprisingly, you have less than a dozen people who are pulling all the strings. All of them, I mean all of them.
Wow.
You do not have a plurality of scientists. You don't have a plurality of institutions. You know, and even after the Imperial College, for example, the UK Imperial College model was wholly discredited, no governor said, hey, we used faulty data to do the decisions we did, so we're going to reconsider our decisions. You didn't hear a single governor say that, right? Despite the fact that even in the public media went as far as to say the model has been proven to be in error. It has been proven to inflate things. The fact that in Texas and in New York and all across the country, we created these MASH hospitals that were for this massive overrun of patients that never showed up. No one ever said, hey, we got it wrong, and therefore all of the things that followed are wrong. What they said was, yes, those models were wrong, but by the way, you still have to wear a mask, you still have to social distance, you still have to do all this kind of stuff. And the problem that makes it self-evident that this is a manipulation is that to date, and this is a point that I make to everybody, to date, the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Office of the Surgeon General, CDC, NIAID, all of the organizations at Johns Hopkins, at University of Washington, and Imperial College, can only point to a computer simulation to justify the illusion of social distancing.
Computer.
Not.
Yeah, computer.
It's a computer simulation.
Wow.
And these are people who are seriously destroying the lives of tens of millions of Americans and hundreds of millions of people around the world. They're destroying their lives purely based on a computer simulation, because there is no clinical evidence, zero, that there is a shred of protective value around wearing a face mask as a healthy population. Those are words from the Journal of the American Medical Association. Those are not David Martin's words. There is no evidence that wearing masks in a healthy population have any effect on the transmission of disease. That's Anthony Fauci just 3 months ago. There is no evidence. But then we're being told by governors that they're going to reopen the states based on evidence. The fact is that they have refuted evidence at every single turn, going all the way back to the beginning of the manufacturing of this pandemic, which, if you go back and you look, remember that we were told that there was a new virus, and in an unprecedented way, we in America took the science that had been less than 10 days old from China and melted down our economy for something that was hearsay. And on February the 11th to February the 20th, we then, following the World Health Organization, backed our own policies into filling their narrative, which was that this virus was unique and it was creating a disease. But here's the tiny problem, Patrick. The tiny problem is the facts don't support the story, because the facts show that positive tests for coronavirus, and this is the people who test positive, which is only 14% of the tested population, but even in those who test positive, over 90% of people who test positive have no clinical symptoms at all. But yes, every governor that shut down their state stated, and I'm quoting, coronavirus causes COVID-19. Now, COVID-19, the definition is pneumonia, is fever, is muscle pain, is loss of smell, it's all those kinds of things. That's what COVID-19 is by their definition. But coronavirus, in 90% of the people that are tested, does not cause any symptom at all. You cannot therefore say coronavirus causes a disease. What you can say is coronavirus is associated in rare instances with a series of clinical problems. But that doesn't make an epidemic, and that doesn't make a pandemic. And every governor has lied to their population, which is the reason why I say they are guilty of domestic terrorism defined under Section 802 of the Patriot Act. And the reason why I say that is very precise. Domestic terrorism defined under the Patriot Act, Section 802, specifically states when you are actually committing a crime where your intent is to coerce a population and to affect a policy or influence a government. Don't think for a minute that the reason why an Andrew Cuomo or Governor Newsom or Governor Northam, don't think for a moment that the reason why they said we needed 30,000 ventilators in New York, or they said we needed a social distance in San Francisco, they did that to influence government assets and resources. You know it. They kept begging for more money, and they did it to coerce a population. That's the definition of domestic terrorism. That's what they've done. And all of the evidence is just absolutely irrefutable and undeniable that that's what's gone on.
Fascinating.
They don't have a leg to stand on. And so what they're doing is they're suppressing every voice that calls them out.
Yes, sir. So on the basic fact, they don't really, governors or public health officials or mayors, they don't really have any constitutional authority to mandate anything anyway, do they?
No, so let's go back to, so Alan Dershowitz made a stupid comment a couple days ago.
And yeah, listen, well.
this is a guy, and I'm being polite.
This is
a guy who's been accused multiply of sexual assault, who is telling you that you can be held against your will and have a needle jammed in your arm, right? I'm sorry, but I have a problem with a person who is accused, at least, of violating women, telling me that you can plunge a device into my arm. I just don't have time for that. But there is a Supreme Court decision that was taken at the turn of the last century in Massachusetts about whether or not a police act by a state, in this case Massachusetts, mm-hmm. allowed a person to be vaccinated against their will. Now, if you go back and you look at the law, it turns out that the law says that you actually could be vaccinated or pay a fine of $5. That's what the law was.
Or pay a fine.
The number of people who've turned this into a you have to be vaccinated argument is absolutely ludicrous, because even the Supreme Court then, and this is the Supreme Court at the turn of the 20th century, even then the Supreme Court recognized that vaccines were in fact a belief. They weren't science. They say it in their opinion, by the way.
Which still stands today, correct, sir?
Right, yeah. Absolutely. So if you go back and you look at that and you say, okay, what's going on right now? What's going on right now is that there is no science that says that we actually have a unique public health emergency. And because there is no science that says we have a unique public health emergency, no governor is authorized to arbitrarily suspend constitutional rights because they have a hunch that they were told by the World Health Organization or by CDC. And the fact is that every declaration that has been made by every governor of a public health emergency, and then every public health officer, as the derivative of that, is based on hearsay. It is not a fact. And there is no justification in any law, anywhere. As Attorney General Barr very eloquently wrote, public health emergencies or emergencies do not suspend constitutional protections afforded to the citizens of the United States.
Even if they're if there was real science behind it, would they be authorized to mandate this or that?
So under the Supreme Court determination of the turn of the last century, mm-hmm. a police authority exists to enforce a clinically accepted public health act. You are never authorized to make it up on the fly. Right. Social distancing has never been validated in any clinical trials. As a matter of fact, the Spanish influenza study, the U.S. Army did a clinical trial on social distancing and found out that infections got worse. So the bad news is the only clinical trial that was ever done actually went the wrong way. It actually said that if you social distance, you don't get immunities and you get sicker. So bad news is the 1918 study that is the only randomized controlled trial said social distancing was a boondoggle and it failed to work. Setting that aside, because they don't want to deal with science anyhow, you cannot make stuff up. You have to have basis of science and clinical fact. And it's really important, Patrick, to understand that no public health emergency allows any organization or any government or any entity within a government to impose rules on a healthy population.
Really?
Quarantine means you can take the sick and keep the sick out of the population, but you cannot, and there is no historical justification for this ever. In fact, in California in 1900, there was a California Supreme Court case which specifically said that you could not specify a subpopulation that is subject to quarantine while you let other people move about freely. And in that particular case, what they said was that it was not legal for anybody to arbitrarily decide that somebody is entitled to move about and someone isn't. Every governor and every public health officer in this country who stipulated that there were, you know, critical employees who were able to do whatever they wanted to do, but non-essential employees couldn't, and non-essential businesses had to be closed, but essential business had to stay open. Those are in violation of the California Supreme Court determination in 1900. But no one is paying attention to these fundamental rights.
And isn't it true that if there's a Supreme Court decision in one state, it actually is good in all the states?
Well,
kind of sort of?
So that's a tough reach, okay, right? So the U.S. Supreme Court.
What was that case, by the way? The belief case. Do you know that?
The Supreme Court. Massachusetts case.
The Supreme Court, where they said that vaccines was a belief.
Yeah. That is the Jacobson v. Massachusetts. The court heard the case and decided it in 1905.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Jacobson v. Massachusetts.
And that's a Supreme Court case.
That's a Supreme Court case. And what that says...
Wow.
And people, and Dershowitz absolutely is parroting the CDC's version of this story rather than reading the actual determination. Because the determination does not allow an individual to be forced into a clinical trial, which, by the way, if somebody tried to vaccinate you today for coronavirus, it would be a clinical trial. That's not legal. You cannot be forced to participate in research. We established that as a globe after the Second World War. The entire version of the Nuremberg construction was you can't subject a population to an experimentation in medicine. We said that that was unethical and illegal. There is no way in which anybody could get a vaccine for a coronavirus infection for the next 2 to 3 years that wasn't part of a clinical trial, which means there's no way that anybody could be forced to get a vaccination for something which hasn't been established to be safe and effective.
Or forced to be tested.
Or forced to be tested. These are all clinical trials, and you are not forced under any law anywhere on this planet to be a subject of a medical experimentation. And if people just stand up for their rights and say, you can't touch me without informed consent. And informed consent means that you can guarantee the safety and efficacy of the thing you're doing. The fact is that neither the CDC nor any public health officer anywhere in this country has the data to support that this is anything other than a clinical trial. And as such, you, as a citizen, have no obligation to participate.
So you can almost feel where they're going, Mr. Martin, is the idea that we want to test everybody and then we're going to classify people who are testing positive. Yeah. But you've shown, yeah, and other people have shown, that the whole test is bogus anyway. So you,
right,
our listeners, the best thing to do is never get tested.
Right. If you feel ill and you want to be tested, go for it. I tell people all the time, at the end of the day, it is your decision on your body and your sovereignty with your body. The fact of the matter is the law, international law and domestic law, says that you cannot be forced to participate in an experiment on medicine. You cannot be forced to do that. There is no law that ever authorizes that under any circumstance, period. And under that provision of law, if somebody comes along and says, well, I got a public health officer that says otherwise, say no.
And we've shown that you'd want to maybe get your county sheriff involved in this and prove to him so he could maybe protect you too if you needed to.
Of course.
Yeah. Because he's the ruler of the roost, isn't he, over all these people, the three-letter agencies.
Well, and at the end of the day, unfortunately, just like the Jacobson, Massachusetts case, and I tell people this all the time, there will be individuals who will have draconian measures enforced on them by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The way you get to establish history, the way you get to stand as a patriot, is to say no. And if that means you go to court, you go to court. But guess what? There are people all across this country who are going to have to stand up and say no.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that we can very easily find ourselves seduced into this notion that somehow or another we are somehow wishing that it would be somebody else's problem.
Yes, sir. So even though we're a constitutional republic, the idea is that majority rules, you know, mob rule, democracy idea, which is not true. So are they, whoever they are, hoping that that's the majority of people are going to fall in the line and they're going to be able to do what they want?
Right.
That's the drill.
Yeah.
Is there any way that, what is the term you use for governors and people that are doing this, that they're, what law, what crime have they committed?
Well, as I've very clearly, and I'll just read this for you because I think sometimes it's good to actually sure. just take it straight from the horse's mouth.
Sure.
But Section 802 of the Patriot Act, which is a, is the only place where the actual nature of domestic terrorism is defined.
Mm-hmm.
It says a person engages in domestic terrorism if they do an act dangerous to human life. By the way, imprisoning people in their own home, restricting their ability to live and make a livelihood is dangerous to human life. That is a violation of a criminal law of a state or the United States. If the act appears to be intended to, number one, intimidate or coerce a civilian population. Now, let's just stop right there. Would we say that governors and public health officers in the United States have tried to intimidate or coerce a civilian population? Absolutely. Number two, influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. How many times did you see governors yelling into the microphones, yelling at population about, we have to have money, we have to have ventilators, we have to have this, we have to have that, we're going to have 2 million people dead, blah, 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 therefore give us money. Is that influencing policy of a government by intimidation or coercion? Absolutely. Or to affect the conduct of a government by mass destruction, assassination, or kidnapping. Have we done mass destruction? Has the unemployment level shot past 30 million? Have we set records for small business closures? Have we destroyed and absolutely decimated our economic population? Absolutely. These, having occurred within the territorial jurisdiction of the United States, are domestic terrorism as defined by the Patriot Act. There is no question that every single governor who has shut their state down has committed this crime.
What would it take for these people to be held accountable, David Martin?
Well, it starts by holding them accountable. It starts by actually calling it what it is. And I am, for whatever reason, I seem to be unique in the fact that I say that liberty must be defended by striking the root of the tree of tyranny. That root is the fact that somewhere along the line, between February the 29th and March the 11th, and those are two very important dates, between February 29th and March 11th, in advance of any clinical evidence to the contrary, 48 of 50 governors were handed a script by someone to declare an emergency that didn't exist. Somewhere between February 29th and March 11th, every governor was complicit, except two, right? They're Maine and I think it's Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, yeah.
48 governors were handed a script and they perpetrated an act on their population, which is an act that is in fact propagating terror on that domestic population. The reason why I say it's in violation of criminal laws of a state or the United States is, as I said very clearly back on April the 27th, 2020, in the video that I think you saw, the fact of the matter is there was a violation of a criminal law that led us to this moment. And the criminal laws were the antitrust acts, the Sherman and the Clayton Act, which are actually felony acts when violated. Those criminal laws are a massive, massive collusion between the Center for Disease Control, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is Anthony Fauci's nonsense, and the Department of Health and Human Services, and the institutions that they conspired with to create this illusion. That is a racketeering and conspiracy program that they promulgated, and they got every governor to be complicit in it by handing them a script that said something that was materially false. Your governor, if you read the emergency declaration, your governor in all likelihood said coronavirus causes COVID-19 or COVID-19 is caused by coronavirus. Mm-hmm. That statement is false. It's absolutely 100% proven to be a false statement, but your governor stated it anyhow, which means they recited a lie, and the lie was described and defined by a series of co-conspirators who meant to do harm for their own economic benefit. They wanted to have, and in February, Anthony Fauci went out as far as to say this, so I'm not putting words in his mouth. They wanted to have coronavirus last long enough to get funding for their research programs and for their drug development programs. And in the Stat article from February 2020, when they were bemoaning the fact that the problem with coronavirus in the past, when we had SARS in 2002 and 2003, when we had MERS, the Middle Eastern respiratory disease that took place 2012 and 2013, they bemoan the fact that because it resolved itself so quickly, they couldn't keep getting federal funding pouring into their programs and into their pockets. And so they needed to create something that would actually move money into their programs. These are criminal conspiracies.
If a governor or a mayor or a public official in a state, David Martin, really believes this letter they get from these people, does he have cover, a legal cover?
You know, the Court of Appeals has a very funny standard, which is called the willful practice of ignorance. I love that.
Willful practice of ignorance. Yeah. What does that mean?
It sounds kind of funny, isn't it? The definition of willful ignorance was a company knowing that it had information that would incriminate itself, but they knew the file cabinet where it was stored and they decided not to open the file cabinet. Seriously, that's where that idea came from, which is as long as I don't look at a thing, I can't prove that I knew it was wrong, right? So that's what the concept of willful practice of ignorance is. A governor who actually is handed something that is an agency of or an extension of a conspiracy is not protected by pretending that they thought that it was fine, right? That would be analogous to being able to say, I smelled smoke in the theater, therefore I yelled fire in the theater. But it turns out that the smoke that I actually smelled was on the jacket of the person sitting next to me, right? Mm-hmm. We use this example all the time. Free speech does not entitle you to being an ass. Free speech does not entitle you to say, oops, I was just joking. Free speech doesn't entitle you to say, oops, I didn't do my homework. For a governor to take the extraordinary acts, and by the way, these are extraordinary. The World Health Organization in February, going up until the 11th of March, was pushing back on calling this a pandemic because they said it can be misapplied to create fear and terror in the population. They knew that they were doing it. So a governor doesn't have a fig leaf to hide behind when on the one hand they say, well, yeah, I just was following instructions coming from somebody. But oh, by the way, I've burnt my state down. I've destroyed the civil liberties of my citizens. I've crushed the hospitality industry. I've made the possibility of having restaurants and bars go away because I have decided unilaterally with no verification, with no independent confirmation, I've decided that I'm going to recklessly endanger the lives of my citizens. And then I'm just going to say, oops, I was just following orders. Well, guess what? It's not a defense.
If we had an enlightened attorney general, kind of a real top-notch attorney, and also like the Dalai Lama's consciousness or something, could they go after these people and really?
Of course they can.
Could they?
Of course they can.
Is there a statute of limitations on it?
Well, the cool thing about statute of limitations is when there is a situation where there is explicit fraud, mm-hmm. right, where somebody is trying to hide their behavior, they're trying to push the evidence of that behavior from the public eye, all sorts of suspensions of statute of limitations are accessible in various types of cases. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, we are obviously still engaged in the terrorism.
Yes.
It's happening, right? The fact of the matter is even the states that try to hide behind the fact that we say we're reopening, ask any restaurateur whether you could cut the number of patrons you have by 50% and keep your restaurant viable.
Oh, with the 6 feet and the tables and everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's beyond ludicrous, right? Telling somebody that they can reopen, but giving them a condition under which their business cannot operate is not reopening.
And
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt, but they're actually mandating people, restaurants in Austin, take the names and addresses and phone numbers of customers.
Right. Oh. Right. These are all things that any ordinary human being looking at it knows that there is something else going on.
Yes.
It is not an acceptable thing. It is not an appropriate thing. And the fact is that you see these overreaches time and time and time again, where governors, where public health officers, where mayors, where public health offices within, you know, departments of health within counties are doing things that are so horrifically, horrifically in violation of civil liberties and horrifically in violation of search and seizure and horrifically in violation of presumption of innocence. Right. We, the healthy, have presumed to be a pariah. We, the healthy, have been presumed to be potential agents of infection. Right. And even that story, by the way, if you go back and look, it turns out that the original study that said that asymptomatic people were highly likely to be transmitting and carrying the disease turns out to be based on false information, too.
It's just false.
Nobody is pulling any of the punches back. And they keep landing the blows on the citizens of this country with impunity. And it is time for us to call it what it is. It's terrorism, and it's terrorism with an intent to harm our civil and democratic systems.
Boy, that's pretty powerful. Whew, man. So we got our work cut out for us because it doesn't look like... you know, I guess big picture, David Martin, do you think the end game is just to see how much they can control people and get away with it without getting too much pushback?
You know, let me just reflect on something. Yesterday, my wife and daughter and I went to the grocery store.
Yes.
And we walked into the grocery store, and we live in Charlottesville, Virginia. We do not have a mandatory mask ordinance here, but we walked in there. And we probably, out of the several hundred people in the store, we were probably maybe six that didn't have a mask on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I found amazing is that if I would have stopped and asked each one of the individuals wearing a mask, can you tell me how you were advised that you need to wear a mask? I would probably get some set of answers like, well, I read it on Facebook, or I saw it on a news story, or I did whatever else. But the funny thing is, very few of them would have actually read an executive order or an order given by a public health officer. Very few of them would actually have bothered reading the fact that the Journal of the American Medical Association on April the 4th affirmed that healthy populations shouldn't wear masks. Very few of them would do that. And it turns out that I think this is a phenomenal psychological and public control exercise to see how much governance can be done by smartphone. Because the fact of the matter is, very few people, and by the way, in our conversation, I'm pointing out documents and I'm pointing out laws that the majority of people don't even know exist.
Yes, sir.
The fact of the matter is, I don't think that most people know what the Constitution provides. I don't think most people know the difference between what the Constitution affords and what the amendments afford. I don't think most people have any clue what is being abridged because they haven't stopped and actually paid attention. So when you are told by somebody who is alleged to be a potential rapist and potential pedophile that you have to have a vaccine, remarkably, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people, will actually recite that as though that's the rules. Yes. But they don't pay any attention to the fact that Alan Dershowitz and Jeff Epstein were very close in association. They engaged in lifestyle activities together, which is well documented. And surprise, surprise, Alan Dershowitz was representing him in his defense for a big shocking reason that he wanted to make sure that certain things that affected him were actually not made public. So there's giant self-interest there. But the number of individuals who are thoughtful, you know, concerned citizens see a headline on their web browser, or they see a headline on their Facebook post, or they see a headline on a YouTube video, and have adopted the notion that if you see it, it exists. The fact of the matter is, as much as people want to hide behind their capriciousness and arbitrary determinations, none of the interventions, and this is just a statement of fact, none of the interventions, nothing about social distancing, nothing about face mask wearing, nothing about that has met a standard of scientific publication that includes a clinical trial showing its efficacy. None of it. And so this is not a kind of close call, but what's happened is that we are testing how controllable a population is by putting up a headline. And don't think for a minute that that's going to be limited to what we call coronavirus. You can see, and I forecast that this would happen, by the way, in my early videos. I told you it was going to happen, and it happened. What is CDC now saying? CDC is now saying that we're going to have a measles outbreak in another couple weeks.
Is that right?
Now, who, you know, which magic unicorn waltzed past someplace in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and whispered in the ear of somebody at CDC, get ready for the next outbreak? We have the occurrence of measles in this country from time to time. But the fact that the CDC is now saying, hey, why waste a great opportunity? We've already terrorized the population with a false event called the COVID scandal. Now let's trump up this whole notion that there's going to be a measles outbreak. And I'm sitting there going, which part of this entire exercise are people not going to wake up to? We are being intimidated for the purpose of testing how far we're willing to bend before we simply fall over and break.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. A couple of questions before I let you go, please. This is a mandatory vax for kids going to school, California and other states. Could moms and dads use this 1905 Supreme Court decision, vaccine as a belief and you can't do it, to keep their kids in school without being vaxxed?
So I have been invited into the whole conversation about vaccines quite often.
I bet
and
you have.
Here's what I'm going to say. Vaccination is an experimentation. Unless the FDA and the Center for Disease Control and public health officers can do three things. Number one, they can show long-term safety and efficacy data. Now, we know that Robert Kennedy and a number of other people sued under a Freedom of Information Act, sued the FDA and sued others to supply information to show that they were safe and effective. And we know that safety and efficacy was not tested. So we know that.
Yes, sir.
Number two, February 2011, the Supreme Court took up a case which was called, and I'll get this name wrong, so I'll spell it.
Okay.
It's Bruesewitz versus Wyeth. It's B-R-U-E-S-E-W-I-T-Z, Bruesewitz v. Wyeth.
Wyeth?
And Wyeth is W-Y-E-T-H, as in Wyeth Pharmaceuticals.
Gotcha.
What the court found was that it was acceptable in this very convoluted way for the vaccine manufacturers to have no liability for the injuries that they caused.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so what happened in the National Childhood Vaccination Injury Act was essentially the United States government decided that in the name of public health, there was going to be a waiver of liability. So the vaccine manufacturers have no liability for harming individuals. And this goes to the theme of what I just talked about in my last video, which is unfortunately, if you look at that 2011 case, which had to do with the concerns about linking vaccines to autism, what was not argued and what should have been argued was the fact that the vaccine manufacturers have willfully, just like they did in tobacco, they've willfully suppressed information showing that what they're doing is harmful. And so what the case turned on was this whole question of the causal links or the association links to autism. And like I said, I'm not weighing in on that. What I'm weighing in on the fact is that we have not had a Supreme Court case where the legality of forced vaccination has genuinely been the topic that's litigated. And so I think it's critical, and this is David Martin speaking his opinion, but I think it's critical that we stop pretending that the 1905 Jacobson case or the 2011 case has settled the fact that somebody can be forced to have a vaccination. The fact of the matter is, like I said before, there is no basis in which any member of the public can be forced to participate in a clinical trial. And if the data is being collected for research purposes, whether it's a phase one, phase two, phase three, or phase four post-approval surveillance, if you are being forced to participate in a clinical trial, you are not required to participate in that trial, period, full stop, end of sentence. And what we have to do is we have to get the citizens of places like California and other places to stand up and argue the correct case. And it is my presumption, and I'm projecting here, but it's my presumption that the reason why we haven't argued the correct case is because attorneys actually fear the reprisals coming from the pharmaceutical industry. And so what they've done is they've litigated around the edges of this issue without going to the heart of the issue. And the heart of the issue is there is no basis in science to let any industry force a product onto another human being that has not been shown to be safe and effective. And as Robert Kennedy's inquiry disclosed, we know that the industry knows that this is not safe and effective.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Finally, what about this idea of it's being pushed, the idea of vaccination diplomas or certificates or whatever, and it feels like we're going to be called upon to have one to fly, or maybe to even give it a driver's license, or I don't know, maybe get a passport. I mean, where would we stand there if we needed to fly or wanted to get a passport?
Yeah, well, this is once again where this will ultimately be litigated. And my encouragement right now is to recognize that between now and the pursuit of liberty, there are going to be conflicts on that journey. But the fact of the matter is, it is going to involve a number of us, and I mean the masses of the citizens, mm-hmm. to say no. People forget that while they, on a individual level, may be one person, they, on a collective, outnumber the tyrants. And it is time for all of us to say no. And as we say no, there is going to be, through the ordinary course of the workings of the system, there are going to be a significant number of us who actually have a period of time where we may not be able to do a particular thing, or we may not be able to take part in a particular activity, until we litigate the fact that this was an illegal overreach. This was something that was opportunistically done by a group of conspiring parties for their economic interest. That is racketeering, that is criminal collusion, and that must be litigated, and we as a citizenship must stand up and say no to it.
Yes, sir. So in the meantime, we're just going to have to just not fly or whatever the case is.
Whatever it is. Restricted will be the basis upon which the argument gets made.
Yes, sir. So do you DavidMartin.com or DavidMartin.world, right? And
yeah, DavidMartin.world. Yep.
So your company, your main company is, do you work with people around the world to help them navigate the financial world? What do you do?
Yeah, well, like I said at the top of the show, I live. what I do is I spend all of my time and effort, seriously, every day of my life, I spend doing everything I can to build a more human experience.
Good for you.
And that means making finance accessible to people. That means getting into post-conflict regions around the world and bringing peace and tranquility and economic revitalization. In this particular case, it means standing up for citizens who don't even know where to put their feet. The fact of the matter is, we spend our time making sure that people have a chance to have the best human experience they can have.
Oh, well said. So where do people see your videos?
David Martin World on YouTube.
David Martin World.
And then DavidMartin.world on my website.
DavidMartin.world on your website. And do you put out videos how often?
Every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, right from Charlottesville, Virginia. My beautiful wife, Kim, produces them. I get in front of the camera, and we do our best to keep people informed.
Well, they're real fun to watch. David Martin's World on YouTube, right?
That's it.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's just an honor to have you. It's just so much fun to talk to you.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah,
Have a beautiful day.
Been a pleasure. You too, sir. David Martin, wow, founder, chairman of m-cam.inc, David Martin's World on YouTube, and also David Martin.world, his website. Now, there's one for the books. I would record this baby, and if you'd like, and to burn a CD, and I would send it to your governor. That's what I'm going to do. I'm sending this guy to the governor's office and tells his handlers, I think you should have the governor, We have a pretty good one. He's wanting, here in Texas, he's wanting to open things up, and then they have a, kind of a socialist mayor in Austin that, they're still making people wear face masks and things like that. So, wow, we are in interesting times. I love you all very much. Thanks for being here. Thanks for your ongoing support. Remember the 20% deal on the hydrogen machine, the Brown's gas, goes on for another 5 days. This is incredible technology. We're just not pumping up sales. Believe me, I've been using this. There's something really good going on with hydrogen and Brown's gas. If you got the money, invest in it. Now's the time to do it. Lifetime warranty. Grab it, get one, and you'll have one in your household for a lifetime. Lifetime warranty, 1 year money back guarantee. Check it out on OneRadioNetwork.com, the AquaCure machine. So I'm going to take the day off tomorrow. We've had a busy week, and then we'll see you in open phones, and we're going to have plenty to talk about on OneRadioNetwork.com. Please pass on these links to everyone that you care about, especially this, well, the two today, but David Martin, this kind of information is just priceless, as they say in the commercials, the MasterCard commercials, to pass it on to people and say, listen to this, and help people to open up a little bit. It's time to stand up and just say no. Again, I love you, and I will see you Friday at 9 o'clock, and may the blessings be.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.